funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, U.S. officials say there could be as many as 650,000 surface-to-air missiles in Iraq, exactly like the one that killed 16 American soldiers. We'll have a report from Baghdad.
Also, joy and despair after the consecration of the first gay Episcopal bishop.
How the unemployed will have to compete with the longtime underemployed in a job recovery.
And what participants in a recent bank merger might learn from a merger back in the 90s.
In the case of Bank of America, the model bank program was not used to consolidate, and they ended up outsourcing, and a lot of those jobs went out of the bank and out of America.
These stories and the exquisite history of Jewish music in America. Coming up, Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. 16 U.S. soldiers who were wounded in yesterday's missile attack on a military helicopter in Iraq have arrived at a U.S. military hospital in Germany. 15 soldiers were killed in the attack. Kyle James reports from Berlin.
The wounded soldiers have been transferred to the Landstuhl Regional Medical Center, where a hospital spokesperson said doctors have been evaluating their injuries. The majority of the soldiers are described as being in serious but stable condition. Most are suffering from broken bones and head injuries, and several are scheduled to undergo surgery. The troops were injured when their Chinook helicopter was attacked on Sunday just outside the Iraqi town of Fallujah. Eyewitness accounts say the attackers used shoulder-fire missiles to bring down the chopper, which was carrying dozens of soldiers headed for leave outside of Iraq. Sunday's helicopter attack is the deadliest single incident against U.S. forces since they invaded Iraq in March to oust Saddam Hussein. For NPR News, I'm Kyle James in Berlin.
The Supreme Court has agreed to rule on the legal rights of patients when their HMO is refused to pay for recommended medical treatment. At issue is whether patients can sue HMOs over such disputes and be awarded significant financial damages. The justices will hear two appeals, one from a patient and one from an insurer. The High Court has declined to hear an appeal from Alabama's Chief Justice over his controversial effort to keep a monument carved with the Ten Commandments on display in the state's judicial building. Alabama Justice Roy Moore was suspended for defying a federal court order to remove the monument. He goes on trial next week on judicial ethics charges. Firefighters in Southern California believe they will have two of the state's largest wildfires contained by tomorrow. Russell Lewis of Ember Station KPBS has more.
Damp and cool weather over the weekend helped firefighters get the upper hand on the larger and more destructive Cedar Fire. That fire charred more than 280,000 acres and destroyed at least 2,300 homes from the rural mountains to suburban San Diego. Officials hope to have the Cedar Fire contained by tonight, but it won't be fully extinguished for a number of days. In northern San Diego County, the so-called Paradise Fire has proved more stubborn. It's burned more than 56,000 acres. Fire officials hope to have that fire contained tomorrow. As a result, hundreds of weary firefighters from around California and neighboring states began returning home over the weekend. At least 16 people died in San Diego during the fires. For NPR News, I'm Russell Lewis in San Diego.
Senator Bob Graham of Florida has scheduled a news conference at which he's expected to announce he will not run for re-election to a fourth term in office. Graham recently ended his bid for the Democratic presidential nomination. He served two terms as governor and is considered one of the most popular politicians in Florida. Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 82 points at 9,883, and the NASDAQ is up 27 at 1960. This is NPR News. In NPR's business update, stocks have registered gains at the start of the trading week, with the Dow and the S&P now at 17-month highs. Analysts say the market is responding to positive economic reports. Manufacturing activity has improved further. The Institute for Supply Management's monthly index rose more than expected last month. Construction spending in September posted its best showing on record. Commerce Department says spending was up 1.3%. Much of the rise was due to an increase in the value of private construction projects. Spending on public projects held steady. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
The report from the government shows the total value of all building projects underway in September rose to just over $910 billion. Much of the rise came as spending by private builders on housing projects continued to accelerate, rising to just over $471 billion. The record run-up in spending came as many builders rushed to complete projects ahead of what some fear may be higher interest rates in the future. As a result, some analysts expect construction to slow somewhat in the final 3 months of the year. The big rise in construction spending occurred in a quarter that saw the broad economy expand by a stronger-than-expected 7.2% annual rate. Along with the run-up in the value of residential construction, spending on hotels, office buildings, and factories also showed gains. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Securities and Exchange Commission says it will warn brokerage firms nationwide of possible regulatory action against them for failing to give clients discounts for large purchases of mutual funds. An SEC official said investigators have found numerous cases where brokerages did not give investors the discounts to which they were entitled. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the N.E.E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The U.S. Air Force could be forced to reevaluate its flight patterns and missile defense measures in Iraq after 16 Americans died and more than 30 were injured in yesterday's helicopter strike. According to Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, attacks of such a nature are part of a war that's difficult and complicated. Joining us from Baghdad is Washington Post reporter Theola Labbé. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Robin.
Theola, we hear reports that before yesterday's downing of a helicopter, reporters such as yourself tried to get U.S. military officials to talk about attempts at surface-to-air strikes to no avail.
I think that the issue of attempts, Robin, is a very serious one and sensitive one because officials here in the military, they have access to so much information about all the bad stuff that almost happened. And I think that their reasoning is, why give out the stuff that's almost happened when there are so many other things actually happening that are going on? We have car bombs. We have assassinations. At the same time, when you're talking about ammunition, you're talking about questions of how many missiles are actually there. The difficulty, and officials have said, is that they just don't know. They're just not sure.
Well, we hear reports that there may be thousands and that, in fact, there are depots of missiles that are unprotected.
That is true. I have had military officials tell me that. They say, we suspect there are 650,000 tons of ammunition out there. But they use the verb suspect. Could there be more? Absolutely, they say more. And they also say that they're not guarding them all 24 hours a day. They are guarding the ones that they feel are the most sensitive or are the ones that have the ability to do the most amount of damage.
Well, Ahmad Shalabi, the U.S.-backed member of the Iraqi Governing Council, has said that he believes these attacks are all under the same command and that they're going to last until Americans turn responsible for security over to the Iraqis. Any sense of when that might happen?
As soon as possible is the word here. This is a process that is happening as fast as it can. In fact, there are plans to send thousands of would-be Iraqi policemen to Jordan to speed up that process because apparently all of the facilities in Iraq are being used at full capacity. Plans to train the Iraqi army. Once soldiers are trained, they are actually going back and then training the new recruits so that process can also be doubled up. As soon as possible is the word. I mean, there's no date given, there's no time given, as fast as we can.
And yet on Saturday, Paul Bremer said that it's going to take till next September to recruit and train the soldiers and officers needed. Is there anything that you see the U.S. military doing to change its tactics in light of yesterday's strike for the next year until next September?
Not yet. The military officials I spoke to last night and today, they say it's so it's so early right now. It's just too soon to tell. Obviously, the questions that are immediately being discussed are who was in this plane, what kinds of soldiers, or did they take all of the necessary safety precautions? And then as those questions are answered, I think we're going to see a ripple effect and then possibly some changes in tactics. But right now, everyone is still in the trying to find out what happened mode. Mm.
Well, Theola, thank you very much.
Robin, thank you very much. Great to talk with you.
Theola Labbe, Washington Post reporter, spoke to us from Baghdad.
Thundering choral music and a standing ovation, as well as protests and the threat of schism, as the Episcopal Church consecrated its first openly gay bishop yesterday in New Hampshire. The elevation of the Reverend Gene Robinson will be viewed as a victory by many gay and lesbian Christians, but it infuriates many conservative Christians. The Episcopal Church is the U.S. branch of the 70-million-member worldwide Anglican Communion. And today, church leaders in Kenya, Nigeria, and Uganda moved to distance themselves from the New Hampshire diocese. Well, New Hampshire Public Radio reporter Raquel Maria Dillon was in Durham, New Hampshire over the weekend. She joins us now. Welcome, Raquel.
Hi there.
Raquel, thanks for joining us. There's a moment in any consecration of a bishop when the assembled congregation is asked if they have any objections to speak now or forever hold their peace. Was that a tense moment yesterday? What happened?
It was. There were about 3,000 people inside the Whittemore Arena, and there were three speakers who stood up in protest in this moment in the ceremony. It's sort of like in a wedding where the priest says, speak now or forever hold your peace.
Yep.
There was one woman from New Hampshire who got up and spoke on behalf of New Hampshire dissident Episcopalians who aren't comfortable with Gene Robinson as their bishop. There was another bishop from Albany who stood up on behalf of 36 bishops from around the country. And there was one gentleman who got up and read this list of sexual activities, and everyone just froze. It was a very uncomfortable moment, and presiding Bishop Frank Griswold interrupted him before it got too graphic.
Partner with one's tongue.
Father
inserting.
Fox, I think you could spare us these details and come to the substance, please.
You understand what I'm talking about?
Yes, I think we do.
Thank you.
And everyone was very grateful for that.
Did Bishop Robinson address the controversy directly when he spoke yesterday?
Yes, he did. He wasn't scheduled to speak, but at the end of the ceremony, he addressed all the people gathered there to support him, and he got a little choked up. He said it was a very important honor for him to be called as bishop, and he asked the folks gathered there who support him to be kind and understanding of those Episcopalians and Anglicans worldwide who don't understand why New Hampshire Episcopalians want a gay man to lead their diocese.
It's not about me. It's about so many other people who find themselves at the margins and for whatever reason have not known the year of the Lord's favor. Your presence here is a welcome sign for those people to be brought into the center. You cannot imagine what an honor it is for you to have called me.
Now, the reception inside the church was very warm, right?
Oh, yeah. They love him. This man is a hero to the majority of Episcopalians in New Hampshire. The ceremony was interrupted several times by thunderous applause. It was incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Raquel, you were outside. A very different scene and mood there.
Yeah, there was a lot of security. Everyone who went in had to go through a metal detector. But as it turned out, there weren't as many protesters as folks expected. There were about a dozen people. There were a few Episcopalians. There were a few people from New Hampshire. But the most vocal ones were from the Westboro Baptist Church in Topeka, Kansas.
God hates fags! God hates fag enablers! Therefore, God hates the Episcopal Church!
But they were outnumbered and completely drowned out by about 100 other protesters who were there to support Robinson. They were from local churches and gay rights groups, a lot of college students, and they sang Amazing Grace and pretty much drowned him out.
Just to finish up, this word schism, this kind of medieval-sounding word, which is very much in the air around all this, are people in New Hampshire talking about the possibility that the worldwide Anglican communion could break apart?
Yes, I think people at the consecration put it in the back of their mind until they were finished celebrating and enjoying the moment. But it will be something they have to face in the coming days.
Reporter Raquel Maria Dillon spoke to us from the studios of New Hampshire Public Radio in Concord. Thanks so much, Raquel.
Thank you.
Amid a growing mutual fund scandal, the chief executive of Putnam Investments, Lawrence Lasser, resigned today. This is a Senate committee is holding hearings on trading abuses in the mutual fund industry, abuses that could be costing mom and pop investors billions of dollars. Ian McDonald, mutual funds columnist for The Wall Street Journal, joins us. And Ian, in addition to Lasser's resignation, Richard Strong stepped down yesterday from the board of directors of Strong Mutual Funds. Why are these guys resigning?
Well, the whole controversy arises from two practices that are problematic. One is market timing, and one is called late trading. In these situations, what's gone on apparently for years is some fund firms have allowed select large investors to market time their funds, which is making rapid in and out trades to try to take advantage of pricing inefficiencies, or late trade their funds, which is when someone buys a given fund at its 4 o'clock price hours after that price is set. What happens when these things are done is that essentially they raise the expenses and reduce the returns for long-term investors who also own shares of that fund.
Insiders doing what outsiders like most of us could never do.
Exactly. It's sort of a new definition of insider trading, and it's far more widespread than any of us ever thought, and it's reached into the boardroom, which is certainly a place we hoped and assumed it would never get to.
Yeah. With hearings in Congress now and New York Attorney General Spitzer investigating, is there a potential for reform? Is all this going to change in the short term?
There is potential for reform. I mean, what's interesting is that right now there's sort of a lot of saber rattling as the New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer, the Mr. Galvin in your part of the world, and the folks at the SEC are sort of battling for a position to get sort of first in line as the people who are trying to right these wrongs.
Yeah, Galvin, the Secretary of State up here in Massachusetts.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Once that's out of the way, we are going to see some real reforms, and they are likely to come from the SEC because securities laws are their purview. Part of the reason why these problems happen is that it sounds odd, but fund companies generally don't have any information on the vast majority of their customers. If you buy a fund through a financial advisor or a broker, all of those accounts under that broker are lumped into one large, what's called a street account. So they don't know anything about you. They just see one large sum coming in or coming out in a given day. That made it very easy for these people to mess about with funds without anyone really catching them individually. What we will see now is a hard 4 p.m. close where you have to get all your orders to the fund itself, not your broker, by 4 p.m. That'll stop late trading. In terms of market timing, one idea is to put a mandatory redemption fee on all funds that would charge you a fee that would go back into the fund's assets if you sold shares within 60 or 90 days of purchase.
So, Ian, if you're an average investor, you've suggested at the beginning of our conversation that you've lost money because of this, right?
Yeah.
Will that money ever be recouped by average people?
Well, the good news is that the vast majority of firms already implicated in this have pledged to offer restitution. It's also important for people to keep this in perspective. A lot of people might think that this is akin to Enron or WorldCom accounting scandals where people were essentially left with nothing. What this is, if you try to visualize it, is a group of large investors and hedge funds essentially scooping pennies from every single investor on several different days in a different mutual fund. Mm-hmm. What did this cost you individually? In sum, it did add up to billions, but individually, one benchmark that a lot of people are using is to figure on 1% of assets per year in the past 3 years. So for every $1,000 invested in a fund that was timed, you lost about $10 per year. So it wasn't a ton of money, and the odds are you're going to get it back in one form or another, but it's really the principle of the thing. These people had a fiduciary responsibility to 95 million investors, and a lot of them, frankly, shirked it.
Ian McDonald, mutual funds columnist for The Wall Street Journal, joined us from New York City. Thanks a lot, Ian.
Thank you.
Just ahead, competing for new jobs, the unemployed, the underemployed, and the newly minted self-employed.
And later in the show, the history of Jewish music in America, from Kurt Weill to Osvaldo Golaha.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
A just-released study of Massachusetts jobless rates has insight into the real state of unemployment today. One in nine workers in Massachusetts is unemployed, or underemployed, or no longer looking for work. A far worse statistic than the state's jobless rate of 5.7% would indicate. And the numbers also show many of these jobs are not coming back. Andrew Sum is the director of Northeastern University's Center for Labor Market Studies. He joins us on the line. And Andrew, start by helping us understand the differences between the categories. There's the traditional unemployed, but you also gauged underemployed and the labor force reserve. What's the difference?
The answer to that is fairly straightforward. The underemployed we use to define those workers who are currently only working part-time. That's less than 35 hours a week, even though when we interview them, they claim to be looking for full-time jobs.
Right.
And that group is an important one because on average they do only work about 21 to 22 hours a week, so that the loss in both their earnings and their output is substantial.
And they don't have benefits, usually.
Many of the part-time workers do not have benefits at all. That's
mm-hmm.
true. And then the third group is what we call the labor force reserve. These are individuals who, when interviewed, claim that they want to be employed at the current time, but because they have not looked for work in the last 4 weeks, will not be classified as unemployed by the household survey. Our view is that all three of these groups, should be counted when looking at the problems of labor underutilization.
And the numbers are much higher when you do count them.
Yes, they are.
And we know that Massachusetts and New England in general are suffering a loss of high-tech jobs, which have gone overseas. But what does this increase in numbers that you found when you studied these groups, what does it reflect nationwide? Is this just unique to Massachusetts?
Both nationally and here, we have this problem of permanent job losers. Not all these, by the way, Robin, are jobs that went overseas. Some of these are just jobs that were in firms in our high-tech sector, our telecommunications sector, software sector, which just lost out competitively or there's been reduced demand. And as a result, those jobs didn't go anywhere. They just vanished completely. But the problems of both those groups is exacerbated by the fact that once they've lost a job, it's taking them so much longer to find anything new. Back at the end of the boom, the average duration of unemployment in our state was only 10 weeks. And now today that duration of unemployment is closer to 21 to 22 weeks.
Mm.
And so as a result, the average person's unemployed is more than, is spending twice as many weeks on average, looking for work than they did before.
Mm.
So what we've argued is that it's the duration of these unemployment spells that is significant a problem as just the increase in the number of these individuals. And that problem has not been given as much attention as it deserves.
Mm. Well, Andrew Sum, thank you so much.
Robin, can I just say one last thing on this?
Is that
in addition to these problems, we also find both here and nationally something that also should be examined, and that is that there's a large increase in the number of people who we call both self-employed because you basically have no other alternative for employment. And a second group that we call contract workers, these are people who are employed but are not on anybody's payroll. They are hired by individuals to do temporary work. We find under both of these groups there's been a large increase in their numbers over the last few years. Individuals who've lost all their unemployment benefits still need some support. We'll end up hanging a shingle outside their house, claiming that they're self-employed, doing something temporarily to help them get by.
Mm.
But the reason why it's important to understand those two groups is when we begin to create new jobs, the individuals who are going to be looking for those new jobs are not just the unemployed and the underemployed, but also all these self-employed and contract workers who will come back in mm-hmm. looking for a permanent job with full-time benefits.
That's a lot of people going after a few jobs.
It absolutely is, which is why I don't believe it'll be why I believe it'll be difficult to lower the unemployment rate dramatically in the very short term.
Andrew Sum, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Andrew Sum, director of Northeastern University's Center for Market Labor Studies.
Well, among millions of workers nervous about their jobs in the U.S. right now are thousands at Fleet Boston Financial, which was just taken over by Bank of America in a $47 billion merger. Fleet Boston said the number of its employees in New England, 21,000, shouldn't change dramatically. But our next guest, Steve Remain, knows a lot about Bank of America's history. He worked for Nations Bank in San Francisco, which became Bank of America after a merger. Steve's the author of Soldier of Fortune 500. He joins me in the studio. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Bill. Good to be here.
Steve, you were at Nations Bank just before it took over Bank of America. You saw that merger coming. Does that situation at all inform this situation between Bank of America now gobbling up Fleet Boston?
Well, I think you need to look back at what happened, the history of it. When they took over San Francisco-based Bank of America, and I think that's an important point. This really is Nations Bank that took over the institution as well as the name. They talked about a program called Model Bank that they said would reduce costs, improve customer service, and accelerate the consolidation. That was a lot of the hype that helped justify the bank. Another important point, 80% of mergers in the last 10 years, studies by McKinsey show, rarely meet the benefits that they think they will on the front end. So when that happens, in the case of Bank mm-hmm. of America, the Model Bank program was not used to consolidate, and they ended up outsourcing, and a lot of those jobs went out of the bank and out of America.
At the time of the takeover, are there usually promises that not that many jobs will be lost? That's what we're hearing now, right?
Oftentimes, what happens is they happen in dribbles. Banks, through market conditions, oftentimes not the fault of their own, are constant pressure to reduce costs and improve profitability to the shareholders. So lots of times it happens in dribbles where you'll see certain jobs being maybe farmed out, software development, maybe call center jobs as they move along, or other ways that they kind of reshuffle the deck.
Steve, as someone who's been on the inside in corporate America, specifically at Nations Bank, which became Bank of America, and at IBM, when you heard about this deal, what did you think about it? And, a little bit now since the deal, what do you think? Is this a good deal?
That's a good question, Bill. And to be honest, I had some mixed feelings. It kind of hits me close to home because I am a Fleet customer. And I looked at it and you start to hear about how this is going to be a good deal and represents, progress in terms of providing more service to customers, et cetera, all those kinds of things. And I think you really need to get, could it be a good deal? Potentially. But I think, as I say, we need to really understand it. That's where I kind of commend the mayor of Boston, the attorney general, some of the others that say we need to really understand this and look at it before, we just go ahead blindly and accept some of the hype and go along with the deal.
Steve Remain is the author of Soldier of Fortune 500. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
Stay with us. There's much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, unexpected fallout from Iraq. Some Republicans are angry at the White House.
That has been a pattern with this administration, to go to Congress and say it's either our way or the highway. And the people that resent that the most are the Republicans who are in the leadership up there.
And the first release of a 50-CD compilation of Jewish music in America.
In the case of some of the Yiddish music theater, they really had to go to great lengths to rescore them because the orchestrations were lost.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. There are reports that leaflets seen in some mosque in Iraq warned of attacks with, quote, modern and advanced methods days before insurgents brought down a U.S. Army helicopter. 16 U.S. soldiers were killed, more than a dozen injured, wounded when a missile was fired at the helicopter as dozens of soldiers were on their way home for leave on Sunday. In Washington, senators from both parties today lashed out at the Securities and Exchange Commission, accusing it of failing to detect abuses in mutual fund trading and of not acting quickly to stem the widening scandal in the $7 trillion industry. In testimony before the Senate Government Affairs Committee, the SEC's enforcement director presented a survey detailing widespread industry abuses, including a finding that one quarter of the nation's largest brokerage houses helped clients illegally trade mutual funds after hours. Justices of the nation's highest court have decided not to enter the fray over public display of the Ten Commandments in Alabama's judicial building. The Supreme Court refused to hear an appeal from Roy Moore, who was suspended as Alabama's chief justice for defying a federal court order to remove the monument. Moore lost the fight in lower courts, and the monument was removed. He goes on trial next week on judicial ethics charges for refusing to comply with the order. President Bush hopes this is the week Congress signs off on his $87 billion package for post-war efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mark Smith reports.
The package would pay for both U.S. military operations and reconstruction in Iraq and Afghanistan. The House already has passed the measure. The Senate's poised to act tomorrow, now that key senators have given up trying to make part of the Iraq rebuilding aid take the form of loans. They had argued Iraq's oil wealth could eventually repay the U.S. taxpayer. The president maintains the last thing Iraq needs now is to add to the crushing debt it's got from Saddam Hussein's three decades in power. At his news conference last week, Bush said the post-war period gives America a historic opportunity to bolster democracy in the Middle East. Mark Smith, Washington.
Some encouraging news today about the economy. Construction spending in September broke records and the upward trend continued in October. The Commerce Department reports that the total value of building projects came at $910 billion as the housing market continues as a strong segment of the economy. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are higher. The Dow is up 77 points at 98.78.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
If you flipped around your television dial Sunday morning, you likely bumped into Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld saying despite the deadly downing of that Chinook helicopter, the U.S. would stay the course in Iraq. Here's Rumsfeld on ABC's This Week.
In a long, hard war, we're going to have tragic days, as this is, but they're necessary.
While the Bush administration insisted it will stay the course in Iraq, the nine Democrats campaigning for president said the U.S. was badly off course there. And the public is showing increasing signs it agrees with the Democrats. An ABC News Washington Post poll shows for the first time more people who disapprove than approve of the president's handling of Iraq. Joining us on the line to talk about all this are members of our D.C. roundtable. David Tribman is executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, David.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. And Sarah Fritz is Washington bureau chief of the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Sarah, last week President Bush came up with an interesting equation. He said increasing violence in Iraq was an indication how well the U.S. was doing, our success infuriating our opponents to ever greater violence. Then yesterday, Rumsfeld said explicitly on one show he would not put a positive spin on the Iraq situation. Is there a sense in Washington the president's tone on Iraq is off?
I think there's a very strong sense of that. I was in an interview with Condi Rice last week with a number of reporters, and she used that same spin, saying this shows how desperate they are. And the reporters just kept coming around and round again, saying, now, what is it about this that shows that they're desperate? And there was just, you know, just an automatic reaction against that kind of thinking.
But, David, it must be exasperating for the president in a sense, must it not? There is a lot going right in parts of Iraq. Much of the country's at peace.
Well, that's right. A lot is going right, and some of the things that are going right are in unusual places in that country where there were grave worries about very bad things going wrong. Mm. And so there is some good news, and there is some reason to celebrate, but you never celebrate. You never say things are good when so many Americans are in such peril and so many die on one day.
So, David, does that cut well and kind of grotesquely for the Democrats that this bad news is good news for them?
Well, yes, but they wouldn't want to say it that way. Mm. It bolsters their case, but it's never good for anybody when the country's in trouble.
Well, how can it be good if the alternative would be to simply pull out? You don't hear any Democrats saying that because they have just not gotten to that point.
Now, Sarah, I think what they're trying to do is saying we shouldn't have been here in the first place. It's your fault. We wouldn't have done it. Vote
right.
for us.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But they're limited in what they can propose as an alternative.
Sarah, Senator Joseph Biden has suggested over the weekend sending more troops.
Well, yes. I mean, that just shows you how difficult this is for Democrats. His view is the president is playing politics by not really going in there and trying to take control. And he is suggesting this, and of course the president is restrained by two things. A, he doesn't have the money because of tax cuts, and B, to go in and send more people would be an acknowledgement, an implicit acknowledgement that he underestimated the situation there.
Democrat Biden's idea is a non-starter, right, David?
Well, I think it is probably a non-starter, and no one is really looking to Democrats in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee for leadership right now on those kinds of issues. So I think where they stand in part depends on where he sits.
You know, speaking of the Senate, it's expected to join the House today in approving the president's $87 billion request to fund the war in Iraq. But Congress seems very restless with this president, too, in many quarters, does it not? Including, for example, powerful Republican Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. He said of the White House attitude to Congress, they have treated us like a nuisance and appendage. There are lots of bruised egos that the president doesn't help the president's case either, right?
That's for sure. And that has been a pattern with this administration, to go to Congress and say it's either our way or the highway. And the people that resent that the most are the Republicans mm-hmm. who are in the leadership up there.
Yeah. David, what do you make of the new poll that indicates that the president has dived from a 75% approval rating in late April to 47% now? Is he simply at the mercy of the latest headline from Iraq? Is there a way that he should be presenting a broader vision that will not make him at the mercy of every new bad headline about Iraq?
Well, in part, there was no way they could stay the way they were. He could have asked his father to learn that. He could have asked President Reagan to learn that. And he also could have asked President Clinton to learn that. And so what can he do? He can hope things turn around. He can show leadership. He can let the Democrats destroy each other. All those things are possible.
Yeah. While I've got you both,
Medicare. What's the betting line from where you sit in Pittsburgh, David, first, and Sarah in Washington? Are we going to get a Medicare bill? David, what do you think?
The betting is that there had better be something, because there will be a lot of questions asked if there's not, and the betting is further that we're probably going to get something, and it isn't going to mean a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. What's going to happen is that I think there's little doubt that they have a great deal of incentive to get a bill. But I interviewed a number of seniors in the St. Pete region where my paper is distributed last week. And almost to a person, they said this is not good enough, that that their current costs were less than what the bill envisions for them. And so even if they get something, I think it's going to be a difficult political sell.
Sarah, just to finish up, this morning, late word that former presidential candidate Senator Bob Graham, a Democrat, of course, will retire and not seek a fourth term. Are you surprised?
Well, yes. It appeared before he ran for the presidency that Senator Graham was looking forward to a long career there.
And so popular, right?
And popular in his state. And, you know, they say, though, that senators are motivated by a desire to be president. And Bob Graham learned this year that he couldn't be president, that he just didn't have what it took to fire up the crowds and raise the money. And so I think that kind of makes people a little more philosophic about their lives. He's decided to retire and teach, and frankly, he'll be very good at that.
He's turning 67 Sunday. Sarah, what could this mean politically? This is, of course, a Democratic seat. The other senator from Florida, a Republican. Republicans with a very slim 51-48 majority in the U.S. Senate. Political fallout?
Well, as you know, Florida is a highly contested state between Democrats and Republicans.
Yep.
And obviously, this gives a big opening to the Republicans. Probably the leading candidate will, on the Republican side, will be former Congressman Bill McCollum, who ran the last time and is very well known in the state and probably has some advantage there.
I want to thank you both. Sarah Fritz, Washington Bureau Chief of the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. Thanks, Sarah.
You're quite welcome.
And David Shribman, Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, the exquisite history of Jewish music in America, way beyond klezmer.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Every day it happens. The elderly languish in beds in bustling hospitals, but they die alone. They've outlived friends and family, or maybe they're estranged from them, and hospital workers are often too overworked to handhold. So the elderly pass away, cold, frightened, and alone. That thought was unacceptable to Sandra Clark, a nurse supervisor at the Sacred Heart Medical Center in Eugene, Oregon. 2 years ago, she founded a program called No One Dies Alone, a bank of more than 200 volunteers who've signed up to sit vigil during a patient's last hours. Sandra Clark joins us on the line. And Sandra, I know that the idea for this came actually 20 years ago because of a personal encounter you had.
I was about to take care of my patients, which there were six or seven, so this gentleman asked me to sit with him. I knew that he was in the dying process. I said I would be back as soon as I had seen my other patients. And by the time I had checked on them, which was probably 30 minutes later, he had died. Mm-hmm. And it left me with a great sense of guilt and frustration.
Well, now you have this program, and I understand that you have up to 200 volunteers. Who are the volunteers?
Well, they're kitchen workers, hospital engineers, administrators, nurses.
And I understand there's a system set up so that they can be called to a bedside. There's a duffel bag that they pick up when they go on vigil. What's in the duffel bag?
Oh, a CD player, a Bible if some people want the Bible read, various CDs, mostly calming music, and a journal so that they can write down about their experience. We also leave a note card with the person after they've died, that in case family is found, they will know they were not alone.
Yeah, and the story of those last moments is on the note card. And it's produced some extraordinary moments. Can you just share a couple for us?
One time we had a patient who was dying, called the family, and they said they hated him and good riddance. And so the engineer came in and sat with this man. They talked about fishing and other things that had happened, and he quietly died with the engineer there at his side.
Obviously, this helps those who are dying. What does it do for the volunteers?
It gives all of us a sense that all employees are caregivers.
I know some of the caregivers have had a personal story where they, too, just felt they weren't there for someone, and this helps make up for it.
Absolutely. We had one woman whose sister died in a car accident, and she died alone there, and this is her way of making up for that moment. A lot of people I have found are alone here in Eugene, and they say they do this because hopefully they will not have to experience dying alone.
You know, it strikes me, Sandra, that this fellow that you feel you overlooked 20 years ago has certainly lived on in this program.
Oh, absolutely. I was talking about that with my husband. I said, you know, here's a person whose name I can't remember, but I'm never going to forget him. And look how he changed how we take care of patients at Sacred Heart.
Well, and now hospitals across the country have been asking about the program, so hopefully it'll spread.
We've just put together an instructional manual on how we created the program, so hospitals can contact us and we can share our information.
Sandra, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sandra Clark, nursing supervisor in Eugene, Oregon, and creator of the No One Dies Alone program. For more, go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Almost 350 years ago, the first Jews arrived in America. And now to honor that cultural and historic moment, the Milken Archive of American Jewish Music in New York is releasing 50 CDs, music the archive has been collecting, preserving, and recording for the past decade. So now we're going to hear all of them. No, only the first five CDs are out, and here to tell us about the music and the Milken Archive project is Here Now classical music connoisseur Ellen Pfeiffer. Hi, Ellen.
Hi, Robin.
What a project. I mean, in the end, there will be over 80 hours of music, 50 CDs, 600 songs. So tell us about this Milken Archive.
Well, it's a project of the Milken Family Foundation, which was established by the brothers Lowell and Michael Milken. Yes, that Michael Milken.
Yes, he spent some time in jail for junk bond trading.
Correct.
But was always known to be philanthropic. So.
Right. Anyway, the mission of this foundation is mostly educational and some medical research. And they are very interested in resurrecting the musical contributions of Jews who have come to the United States.
Right. And I understand that the Alan Lomax Project, for instance, the Smithsonian Folkways Project, he traveled the country and recorded people in their element. But this is more,
this is new recordings of sometimes older material.
Yeah.
I understand there is some component of archival work, but these recordings that are coming out now are all newly recorded.
Yeah. Well, let's hear some first, because some of the names are familiar. I'm thinking of the composer Kurt Weill.
Yes, this is Kurt Weill, like you've never heard him.
Mm-hmm.
It's straight music that he composed for a gigantic pageant that took place in Manhattan to celebrate the history and culture of the Jewish people. And it also had something of a Zionist propaganda mission as well. It had 153 performances. Hasn't been seen complete since.
Because it sounds too big. I mean, I understand it went all night, 1,700
yes.
costumes.
Right, 245 actors. Enormous.
And they had to pre-record the orchestra because they couldn't fit it on stage.
That's correct.
That is Kurt Weill's The Eternal Road, a pageant that he staged how many years ago?
In 1937.
And re-recorded for this Milken Archive.
That's correct.
It's beautiful.
It's and very different from the Kurt Weill we all know.
Not exactly what Mack the Knife, but...
No, no. Or The City of Mahogany.
Who are some of the other composers in the archive?
Well, they're all varieties from all idioms. There's classical, theater, liturgical, you name it. And some of the names are familiar, like Weill, like Leonard Bernstein, Osvaldo Golahoff, and then some are completely unfamiliar to many of us, such as Darius Milhaud, the French-Jewish composer who came to the United States in the 40s and taught at Mills College. And he wrote a complete sacred service for a synagogue in San Francisco. I think if you hear this piece, you'll think, oh my goodness, that sounds a lot like Poulenc's Gloria, which came about 12 years later.
Darius Milhaud's Service Sacred 1, again from the newly released Milken Archive CDs. These pieces are so beautiful, but they also remind us this took a lot. This was a huge project to re-record these pieces.
Yes, indeed. And in the case of some of the Yiddish music theater, they really had to go to great lengths to rescore them because the orchestrations were lost. And so they had to put them into performing editions.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorites is this album, Abraham Elstein's Yiddish Stage Songs. He was born in the United States and sang in synagogue choirs. He sang in the Metropolitan Opera Choir. He went to Juilliard. And he toured with Molly Picon as arranger, accompanist, and conductor, and wrote a lot of songs for her, some of which she wrote lyrics for. And this one that we're going to hear now is called Abi Gesund, and it was one of Picon's theme songs and expresses the quintessential Jewish sentiment of as long as you have good health, you can be happy.
A bisschen Sinn, a bisschen Regen, ruhig auf dem Kopf zu legen, Abi Gesund können glücklich sein. A Schicht.
Abraham Elstein's Yiddish Stage Songs. When might this have been performed originally?
In the 30s.
In the 30s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, whenever people think of Jewish music, they tend to think of klezmer.
Yes.
And where does that fit in this collection?
Well, klezmer, of course, is a Yiddish contraction of the Hebrew term that meant instrumental song, but it came in Yiddish to mean just an instrumental musician, usually somebody who played in a wedding band or street band. And it featured, you know, a lot of solo clarinet or solo violin playing, very florid embellishment, a kind of ecstatic dance music. And it permeates a lot of the music. And what we're going to hear now is a piece by Osvaldo Golahoff.
My favorite contemporary
yes.
composer, but that move on.
Called Rakitikya. And he, in this piece, envisions a shofar, which is a traditional Yiddish instrument on a rocket ship being blasted out into the future.
Golchow's Rakitka, and makes me hope that his full pieces, I'm thinking of The Passion, will also be in this series.
I don't know about that. It might well be, although it is already on recording. Mm. So,
was that one of the considerations, if you can't
get
it anywhere
else? I think
probably
they would give preference to pieces that had not been recorded, that had not been heard.
Again, the first five CDs of the Milken Archive are being released now, but ultimately there's going to be 50. Something that we should look forward to?
Yes, they will be released over the next few years, usually at a rate of about 2 per month.
Mm. And out of the first batch, Ellen, do you have a favorite?
Yeah, I want to go back to Abraham Elstein. This is another Molly Picon song that, again, she wrote the lyrics to. It's called Eugen, or Eyes, and it's all about her infatuation with the dark eyes of her beloved. And what's just knocked my socks off was, after a very kind of conventional introduction, you get to the verse and suddenly you have a habanera rhythm. And it's just so infectious, okay. Just captivating.
Famous Jewish songstress Molly Picon, as sung now by Elizabeth Shamas in, again, these new releases from the Milken Archive. Ellen, thanks for sharing them with us.
My pleasure.
Here in Oz classical music connoisseur Ellen Pfeiffer. For more information on the Milken Archive of American Jewish Music, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories, Here and Now.
Another state explores gambling to try to solve a budget crunch.
And the nuts and bolts of the habit of creativity. Secrets from choreographer Twyla Tharp.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.